Support for this episode of Judaism Unbound comes from the Ashman Family JCC in Palo Alto, California, whose vision is to be the architects of the Jewish future. The Ashman Family JCC empowers you to experience Jewish paths toward a life of joy, purpose, and meaning through innovative Jewish learning and wellness programs, community building, and initiatives to develop the next generation of Jewish leaders. Learn more at www.paloaltojcc.org. This is Judaism Unbound, episode 329, Workshopping Judaism. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rofberg.
And before we start today's conversation, just an invitation to join us tomorrow night, that's June 4th, starting at 5 p.m. Eastern Time, for our Shavuot Live 24-hour celebration of Jewish learning and thought. That's taking place on Zoom. If you want to register, just go to judaismunbound.com and click on the Shavuot Live button, and it'll take you to the registration page. Registration is absolutely free, though, of course, donations are always welcome. We'll talk to you in the weeks ahead about the possibility of making an end of our fiscal year donation before June 30th. That would help us a lot. So whether you join us or not, we want to wish you a happy Shavuot. It's Lex's favorite holiday. And I should note that Lex generally stays up for the entire 24 hours of Shavuot Live. So you should join us at 5 p.m. Eastern on Saturday, June 4th. But if you really want to have a little fun, join us around 3 p.m. on Sunday, June 5th to see the state that Lex is in. In any event, you can just register once and then you can come anytime you want. So now let's welcome our guest today, Kendell Pinkney. Kendell Pinkney is the founder of a new project called The Workshop. It's North America's first arts fellowship centering the work of JOCISM, that's Jews of Color, Indigenous Jews, Sephardi, and Mizrahi, artists and culture makers. The workshop seeks to stir up, interrogate, incubate, expand, trouble, and revitalize notions of Jewish art by setting the creative processes and the support of artists as the highest priority. Over the course of a year, fellows receive artistic mentorship, financial support, research support, and access to work and performance space. And they learn together regularly, building a creative community with one another and with partner organizations. And most critically, they present their work at seasonal performances across New York City. Our guest today, Kendell Pinkney, in addition to being the founding artistic director of the workshop, is the co-director of Exploring Black Narratives, an immersive education program that foregrounds plays by acclaimed Black writers. Kendell Pinkney makes and supports work that probes the intersections of race, narrative, collective memory, and sacred myth and text. As a playwright and musician, Kendell Pinkney's individual and collaborative artistic approach is deeply rooted in a commitment to foregrounding themes of uncertainty, mystery, and doubt as a means of exploring how these tenuous realities orient us to our humanity. Pinkney has served as a rabbinic fellow for the Jewish arts and culture organizations Reboot and LABA. He is a graduate of the NYU Tisch Graduate Musical Theater Writing Program and just recently graduated with rabbinical ordination from the Jewish Theological Seminary. I should note that he did one of the videos on the Akedah Project, which is a project that we put together in the pandemic as a proof of concept for an idea that we have to explore Jewish texts through the use of video. And Kendell Pinkney did an incredible video looking at the story of the Binding of Isaac from his perspective as a Jew of color. It was really a great contribution to that. And we are so excited to continue this relationship with today's conversation. Kendell Pinkney, welcome to Judaism Unbound. It is so great to have you.
So great to be here with you all.
Well, I'm excited to talk to you because I'm always on the hunt for a good conversation about artists and the role of artists in Judaism and all that stuff. Our good friend Amichai Lalevi had this statement that artists are the new rabbis, and then he changed it to rabbis are the new artists, which I got confused about, and I wasn't totally sure what that means. But you're actually now a rabbi who is an artist, so I'm hoping that maybe you can kind of tease some of this out with us. What do you see as the function of art in Judaism? You know, like, what you're doing all these projects, like, what are you trying to do?
Yeah. Wow. Depending on who you ask in my family, I might be trying to do too many things. So it really depends. So there's the function of art within Judaism. But I think I always start from a place of what's the function of art. And I tend to be in my relationship with my wife, I tend to be the person who's just like very associative thinking, kind of like, you know, I describe myself as a cloud, and I describe my wife Martine as like a mountain, like really helps me focus on like, oh, practical things in ways that I normally don't tend towards. And the reason that I give this little bit of intro is that this actually kind of like even just describes the way that I think about art. Like it's this exploration process. It's very much not linear. But when I try to focus on what's the purpose of art, I ultimately come to this place of it's trying to get me, trying to get an audience, trying to get whomever to understand a different perspective and hopefully find some way of feeling into that new perspective, that new way of being. At its core, art is trying to bring us to confront certain truths about our humanity. In some cases, it can help bring about mutual understanding. And in other cases, it seeks to provoke and actually make you angry in the hopes that you'll actually be like, oh, wow, that this piece of art made me angry. That is so rare. Why am I so angry about this thing? Like some of the best plays I've seen actually made me very, very angry when I saw them. And that was actually a profound lesson about, oh, what is it in my story, my humanity that was triggered by watching this particular story? But then I also think about what is the function for the artist? And I think that it's about expression. There are so many ways in which expression is limited. The older we get, there are certain ways that are thought of as, oh, these are the ways in which you express yourself. With words, you must be clear, you must be concise if you want to have the greatest effect. But when I actually think about the creative process, it's so not at all clear what the next step is supposed to be. And yet, for me, primarily as a writer, that's exactly the process that I need to go through. So I am seeking out how can I express what's actually happening inside of me rather than relying on these maybe more clear-cut forms of maybe a high school essay where it's like, okay, here's my opening paragraph, and then here are three supporting paragraphs, here's my conclusion. Finally, what I would say with respect to Judaism, that's really an open question. The function of art in Judaism, I mean, I don't have great clarity on that actually, because when I think of asking so many of my friends who are artists, they're like, oh, do you consider yourself a Jewish artist? Or if I were to ask them that, they'd be like, well, I'm an artist who happens to be Jewish. The work that I make is kind of Jewish by extension. And if you try to define Jewish artists a little too much, then is it suddenly parochial and has it lost something? Actually, I'm still trying to figure that out myself.
I want to think about the audience for a second, because the way that you are describing art, that it's about provoking and about various other verbs that you used, and I'm thinking, like, my question basically is that if we think about Judaism the way that many people do think about Judaism, as something fundamentally to be conserved, to be held onto, the chain of tradition should be unbroken, then it feels to me like art, as you described it, doesn't exactly belong. Because what is its point? If it provokes you and you're angry, then what are you supposed to do? Suck it up, right? Because it's not supposed to change. So it feels to me like there's something that's inherent about taking art seriously that would mean that Judaism cannot be primarily something to be conserved. And if that's the case, what can we imagine a Judaism would look like that had an extremely vibrant and healthy art world as you described it? What would the impact on that Judaism be, whether intentional or not, on the part of the artists who, like you say, may themselves not regard themselves as Jewish artists or people trying to do, but nevertheless, it feels to me like if there were a vibrant sense that there's an incredible amount of art going on that's connected to Jewish life, that something would really be different in Judaism than how most of us experience it. I'm curious, like, how that strikes you.
I think you bring up a lot of good points, that especially if we think about Jewish tradition as something to be conserved and we have a really narrow understanding of what that word means, then absolutely art can even be seen as threatening. Through my field of specialty and like plays, playwriting, it's like if we think of conserving Judaism narrowly that way, then suddenly it's like, well, we can only have plays that really talk about Jewish uplift or that address the history of the Holocaust. Or maybe we can have a bibliodrama or a Purim spiel. So if we think about if we really stick to that narrow definition of conservation, then I see your point. It just so happens that part of what drew me to go to rabbinical school was actually being exposed to Jewish texts that are very much not, seemingly not concerned with conservation and propriety. Rather, it's, oh, this story is just simply wild. Like I kind of always talk about the story of, what is it, the prophet Elisha, who in the Tanakh, like there are some kids who are making fun of his bald spot and he calls down a curse upon them and then a she-bear mauls them. It's just like, what is this? This is insanity. Like you want to tell me, oh, like, let's conserve the morality of this book. It's like, no, actually some really cool and interesting and weird stuff is happening there. And then when I think about the structure of like, how was it that Judaism persisted, reformulated, rebooted itself after the destruction of the temple? I mean, the incredible creativity that had to happen in order to bring about rabbinic Judaism is, I think of that almost as like a kind of artfulness. Like there's definitely a lot of craft that was involved for the rabbis, early rabbis, to be able to restructure and reconfigure some sense of community. And what's more is I think that the artistic process for a lot of artists, there actually is always a chain of tradition. For example, the number of shows in the last decade that have had the play Waiting for Godot as kind of its base text. It's kind of this absurd play where two characters are waiting for another character named Godot to arrive. Godot never arrives, spoiler alert. Yet that's actually been used as like the basis of so many plays. One of the recent ones actually being the play that was recently on Broadway, Passover, which is set in an urban landscape with two Black men who are waiting on, I guess one might even say waiting on freedom to arrive. And it's blending in all of Waiting for Godot, and it's blending in elements of the Exodus story, part of the reason it's called Passover, and it builds something completely new. So that's very much like in conversation with tradition. The real question is, can we actually be okay with that more dynamic understanding of conservation?
I love the Cloud Mountain situation you described with you and your wife. I would love to go mountain for a second and get practical. yeah. And not that, no, look, the cloud is where we dwell literally as a digital organization, but it's also where we dwell less literally as up in the sky thinking big picture. But the mountain, the practicals, tell us about the workshop. I'm really fascinated by the workshop. I'm always, I mean, it's a trope at this point for followers of this podcast. I ask people about the names of things constantly. So A, I think the name workshop, the workshop, is very funky, especially because it's a project devoted to art, right? Like so much of our world, we've created this duality of like craft work. And then like on the other hand, art in a visual sense or in whatever sense. Workshop seems to blur it. I also get the sense from workshop, like the verb, oh, let's workshop this. Let's try some stuff out, right? Like that is beautiful to me, especially because we're a project that wants there to be different attempts and experiments that are, you know, half thoughts that are turned into Jewish creations. So like, tell us about the workshop. I mean, if you want to talk about the name, that would be greatly appreciated by me, but also just what is this project of yours? How has it looked so far? How is it, you know, moving into the future?
So what the workshop is it is, it's always so weird to use, like I'm always in pitch mode. And so like certain words that like, it is America's premiere, but no, being more serious, it is among the first arts and culture fellowships for professional artists who happen to be Jews of color, Jewish indigenous, Sephardi and or Mizrahi folks. It was founded in the summer/fall of 2021. And it has a lot of different programmatic components, but at its core, we take anywhere between 4 and 8 fellows each year. They come from a variety of fields. So we have quite a few writers this year. We also have a choreographer, a visual artist, musicians, and we meet once a month over the course of a year in order to do a few things. One, we study classical Jewish texts around a theme. This year's theme is collective memory. How is it that societies remember? How is it that societies forget? And who has the power to enforce remembrance or forgetting? So we get together and we study once a month. And we also do a workshop process where we get to talk about, here's what I'm working on. Here are some of the problems that I'm facing with what I'm working on. I'd love to get your input. It becomes kind of an actual, like almost studio workshop where we get to work on things and get feedback from this wonderful little community of diverse Jews. So all of our fellows get an unrestricted stipend to do whatever they want with. They also get a production stipend, which the production stipend is targeted towards the two salons that the workshop puts on each year. So the salons are where we actually show a little bit of the work in progress to the broader community, since so much of our work is actually just as a group with ourselves. All of our fellows are doing really, really well. In fact, two are working on Broadway right now, one off Broadway, one person just featured in Dance Magazine. Like, our fellows are doing amazing stuff. And yet it means something completely different when your mentor is a showrunner for a show on Netflix. It's just like, that's a different level of mentorship. So all of our fellows get mentorship. So the whole idea is to just build a program that has so much support to allow the artists to do what they want to do and to do it within a community that they've probably never had the chance to do it in. And it's been really gratifying to just see that people think that it actually, you know, this is a worthwhile idea. But the thing that really gets me is that even since our first meeting last year, we have meetings that go for 3 hours, and that's intentional. We really want to take time and get into stuff. I always worried, like, oh, is that too long? Will people want to leave? Almost all the time, everyone stays longer than 3 hours. That feeling of community, that feeling of support, it's deep.
Well, that makes sense, because if artists are the new rabbis or vice versa, we know that the rabbis at the Passover Seder, they stayed up all through the night. It's part of the telling of the story of the Haggadah. So like, if artists are doing, then of course they have to stay at meetings for a really long time and sort of flex their muscles in that way.
Exactly.
I want to ask a question that I feel like we have to ask, and we have asked many other times, which is sort of the elephant in the room. Like, what is Jewish art? Right. And you alluded to that a little bit before. And truly, both Dan and I and like the guests we have, I feel like when we talk about this question, we're like talking about it and also kind of annoyed that we need to talk about it, because the subtext there is that like there are lots of projects out there, lots of institutions, et cetera, that define that in a specific set of ways and then like fund the things they define and don't fund other things. And right. Sometimes the way that that's defined is sort of restrictive, conservative in that conserved sense, not the movement, definitions of what Judaism is, like we were talking about before, right? Like if you think that Judaism is a defined thing that is already sort of set, then Jewish art would be the set of arts that take a piece of that existing thing and put it in the world, right?
Right.
And I don't mean to be overly simplistic. It's not just like, oh, Jewish art is paintings of menorahs. But like, I do think that there is a danger in seeing Jewish art that way. What excites me is I don't think that's your sense, but I guess I'm asking a two-part question, which is like, how do you define what Jewish art is? And I mean that practically, because I know like in the abstract, all of us want to say, you know, we're expansive about that and we're ready for new things to push our definitions, but also like, You have fellows that do a certain set of things. And like, I could imagine there would be other people doing cool things that we'd all recognize are cool, that you would be in a position where you say, you know what, that doesn't meet what we are. And it's not that we want to say, ah, we're like the Trafer kosher police and we're marking certain things as authentic or not. But like, still that does have to happen. So I'm curious, like how you navigate that, what quote unquote counts as Jewish art. And also, like, any thoughts you have on whether we're asking that question too much?
Ooh, yeah, that is, especially when you are in a system where you do have to think about funders, it becomes a question you have to contend with one way or another. So I'll start, I guess, by tackling this with respect to the workshop. We really do have, like, I try to have as expansive an understanding of what it means to make Jewish art as possible. So what do I mean by that? So all of our fellows, some would say they are Jewish. Some are very much like, I am ambivalent and marginal. And had it not been for my friend who recommended I talk with you, I definitely would not have applied for this. I want anyone who is in the workshop to feel that they can come exactly as they are. And it just so happens that in the case of everyone who's part of it, there is some kind of Jewish family connection. Yeah, interest. That's interesting. I didn't actually think, like, I think I'm the only convert involved in the workshop and I'm leading it. So for me, that is enough. And then next I'm like, I foreground, what is it that you want to be out there doing as an artist? What is it that you want to be making? Because I believe artists create from those places that are most essential, those places of hurt, those places of joy. And when you let the artist do what they're going to do, you are going to be much more satisfied with the result. And the fact that they are being in community with other Jews of color, Jewish, indigenous, Sephardi, Mizrahi folks, it's going to influence how it is they're thinking about their art. I don't need to sit there and say, I need you to make me a Purim spiel. I'm not a huge fan of Purim spiels, but that's besides the point. But it's like, when you let artists do what they do, you're going to get a better result. And so that's why I tend to have a very expansive definition of what Jewish art is. When I step away from thinking specifically about the workshop and kind of thinking more theoretically, what is Jewish art? I think that I also take a very expansive view. I'm going to try this out. I know I've mulled it over before, but I do think that art that is made by a Jew, generally speaking, is Jewish art. And then maybe the context that I would add around that is actually the context of a question that kind of gets at the core of, like, what does it mean to be Jewish? What is Judaism? I don't have, you know, a very clear textbook answer, but rather I have at least a clear question. What is a Jew without memory? And since this year, the fellows were studying collective memory, all of our fellows have this collective memory of their Jewishness and what that means and what it means to be connected with their families and ways in which they felt possibly even alienated from family or other Jews. But there's still some tie into that collective memory that makes it to where they all identify strongly in many ways as Jewish. So when I think about Jewish art, I never want to force artists to feel that they need to take a specific Jewish text and take that and make some art around it. I mean, that's honestly just going to lead to the most boring art, unless that is exactly what an artist is interested in. So those aren't clear definitions, but that's kind of what I think about anytime I get asked about Jewish art. But I will say that what our artists are making, the quality of what they're making and the questions that they're asking are fresh. And audiences have told us that they simply hadn't thought about, for example, what must it feel like to be torn between saying Kaddish or not saying Kaddish when your African father who is not Jewish has died? How is it that you wrestle with your identity to come to some sense of closure, especially because you have in Judaism these ritual technologies of gaining closure, but is it yours to say Kaddish for your non-Jewish African father? That's just one example. And the reason that I bring that example up is because one of our fellows who wrote a monologue on that, Rebecca Simanga Frank, has done it publicly. So it's not as if I'm putting her on blast or anything like that.
That's an amazing example. But basically, I was going to ask you the kind of question that funders ask, I'm sure, which is, how would having art and taking art more seriously, how would it change Jewish experience? And would it change it in a way that I, funder, like? So I'm curious if you have a kind of a vision of, like, where, I mean, I know it's a lot of pressure to say when it's a brand new program, but, you know, where would all this be going? Like, in your fantasy sure. world, like, how many fellowship programs would there have? How many artists a year would we need to have in order to have really important transformational impact on the Jewish community, for want of a better way to phrase the question?
when I think about the impact that I want the workshop to have, I think about it in very personal terms. So, you know, my first child is just a month or so away from being born. And when I want, you know, my child to like look out onto the creative landscape, I would love for my child to be able to look at it and be like, okay, yeah, there are Jews of color everywhere. There's Black Jew there, a Latinx Jew there. Like this is common. And so I think that for me, a lot of what motivates this is that sense of wanting for there to be more examples of Jews of color in public places, creating work that is impactful where they can be seen in their full complexity. So ultimately, I would love to see something that is developed inside of the workshop actually go on and have a much bigger life and have a much bigger cultural impact, whether that's as an off-Broadway play or if it's an exhibit at a certain gallery or a lovely like choreography program like at the Joyce or something like that. So when I think about broader impact, I'm thinking about it in many, many steps. This first step, this first part of the fellowship is really about community, developing JOCISM community as artists. And then as we build out our alumni programming, there are going to be many more ways to help people along with their projects and hopefully create some things that are going to have some real big impact. So that's the big, big goal. But I think the question that you ask around funders and funders' priorities is a really important question, and it's a challenging question. I have been a part of too many organizations or seen too many organizations where the mission drift is so serious because it's like, oh, a funder says we can have this amount of money if we would just do this. And inevitably, that ends up hurting what's so special about that organization. Ultimately, I trust what it is that we're doing enough to acknowledge that we're not going to be for every funder. There are going to be some funders who are going to want to say, I want Jewish identity and the formation of Jewish identity in a specific way to be the absolute core of this program. Otherwise, I can't invest money and I would have to be okay. Completely understand that. For the workshop, we look for that sweet spot between arts funders who happen to be Jewish and see something like really special is happening here, and also those Jewish funders who have a much more expansive vision of what is worthwhile to fund. And the thing that I will say, just kind of answering that, because we always get these questions around, oh, how? What about their identity formation, the people who are in the fellowship? Like, how do you track that? How do you know it's having an impact? Well, to actually have a community of folks who, even though they have their very specific experiences, also share something of your experience, it's profound. It gives you a different kind of strength to be able to go and make the work that you need to make.
I have, I think, a nerdy question that is selfish because I've been like sitting with this randomly the last few weeks. And also, to some extent, talking with our New Voices Judaism Unbound fellow, Eli, about it. I want to talk about visual art versus written art or non-visual art. And I mean that in a particular sense, because like so much of what we talk about when we're talking about Jewish art is like remixing elements of ancient or at the very least like past Jewish traditions with new stories. What I think we often don't talk about is like the Torah doesn't have pictures, right? Like that's a factual statement about whatever genre the Torah is. And what's interesting, the Torah does actually do some visual things. There are parts of it where the words are arranged in sort of interesting visual ways that are conveying, like this part probably matters and maybe do something with this if you're somebody reading it. But it doesn't have pictures. And I've been thinking a lot lately about how that might be both its greatest strength and its greatest weakness. We've talked about this in other ways on the podcast. We're like, Dan has a favorite text of his about comics that says that like the best comics or the best animations or cartoons are those that give very little detail, that are actually like almost stick figures because they're the most relatable. Anybody can picture themselves as a stick figure, as opposed to like once you give it lots of detail and it looks like a specific thing, like if it looks like a man versus a different gender, if it looks like a white person versus a black person, if it looks like all of a sudden you're narrowing sort of the universality of the picture to be like a specific thing. But I think part of the Torah's strength is it doesn't do that, right? Like everybody reading this text can picture whatever they picture. And I think it's a huge weakness. The lack of like having sort of a visual or an association for like different biblical characters is evident sometimes. And I would point to things like the movie The Ten Commandments, which for a lot of people, they picture Moses as Charlton Heston if they are of a certain age and watch The Ten Commandments. For people of a different age, millennials, shout out, we might picture Moses as Moses from Prince of Egypt. One of those is a white person and the other is very consciously a person of color is a complicated term to say about somebody from thousands of years ago. But at the very least, Moses does not have white skin in the movie Prince of Egypt. And so that's both great because when I think about Moses, I have like a picture in my mind and that makes it more relatable for me. But at the same time, like if I see somebody else's picture of Moses, there's a part of me that's like, that's not Moses. Like, I know what Moses looks like. And so I'm curious how you relate to different fellows who are doing like written work or storytelling versus visual work, because like whether to make something universal by actually not having a face, a specific face, could be a really empowering thing. It also could be really not empowering and just perpetuate status quo, because if we don't actively create the picture of Moses that isn't white, we sort of inherited pictures of Moses that are white. So I'm curious, like, how do you relate to those questions of like the visual versus the not, and how those different media lend themselves to different kinds of strategies?
It's an amazing question that I haven't had as much time to think about, though I'll definitely try out some thinking about it now. The first thing I say is like, I specialize in the written word. That's what I do. And so it was a conscious choice to make sure that not only writers and theater people and film people are part of this fellowship. So when it comes to understanding how other creative media work, I rely so heavily on our other fellows. Like, they are my rabbi in that respect. But when I do think about this really interesting idea of maybe the strength and the weakness of the Torah is that it doesn't have pictures, it actually takes me to a question of genre. Depending upon the creative genre that you're in will determine how much detail to give and such like that. So, for example, comics. I do agree that there's something about the genre that makes it to where stick figures talking about the most trenchant of human experiences is actually kind of profound in the ways in which we like map our stories onto theirs. That's a very strong choice. And one could go in the exact opposite direction with comics and actually like really build out a world, tons of story, tons of images. And that also has its strengths and also its compromises. When I think about Torah, though, it's almost like scaffolding at times. Like, we really do have to fill it in. And that in and of itself is a blessing. And yet, because we are humans who live in bodies, who live in societies where we have to deal with systems of power, our collective memory gets stuck. For example, the Ten Commandments, that kind of conditioned an entire generation's understanding of what does it mean to have a holy man who receives words from on high. Well, of course, he is white. That conditioned how a significant portion of Americans saw it, including my parents, very much including my parents. I mean, my dad always would watch the Ten Commandments. And then I, of course, grew up with the Prince of Egypt. Or, you know, to think about it another way, to go beyond Torah. So if you had, if 15 years ago, you had asked, like, name two or three founding fathers for me, you would not have heard the name Alexander Hamilton. Now, because of Hamilton, it's like, okay, lots of young people, that's going to be in their top three, maybe right after George Washington, maybe above George Washington. So I think that also points to the power of art and the power of artists, especially when something really takes off in the cultural consciousness. You have that capacity to shift the stories. And I think, at least from my perspective, I think that narrative tends to do that really well. But I like the fact that Torah isn't as explicit as it could be. That gives the artist more room to play with.
I have two questions that may or may not actually be connected to each other, and you're invited to connect them or take them separately. The first one is I want to just pick up on what you were saying about Hamilton and sort of speculate about the possibility of a new Jewish Hamilton, or really a new Jewish Fiddler on the Roof, or the Ten Commandments, meaning there are actually, I mean, you talked about who are your two top founding fathers. You know, it's like, who would be the two or three, if you said two or three pieces of art that have really had an outsized impact on what it means to be Jewish in the 20th century, let's say, right? Then we could probably put Fiddler on the Roof and the Ten Commandments and I don't know, a couple other things. But it feels to me like if we are serious about the idea that we are hoping actually for a very different Judaism than one that is focused on the Fiddler on the Roof and the Ten Commandments, including the whiteness of Moses and the Ten Commandments. So I guess question number one, I mean, maybe this just isn't how art works. Like I'm part of the question is that I'm saying to you, oh, Kendall, you're a musical theater artist. Like, can you please write the next Fiddler on the Roof? Because we really, really need it. How does that work? Or is that just not how it happens? It's like artists do their art and every once in a while something breaks through. Why was it Hamilton? Like, to what extent was Lin-Manuel Miranda consciously trying to do something? I think he was consciously trying to do something. To what extent did he actually think that it could break through in the way that it did, et cetera, et cetera? So question number one just has to do with big art, right? And something that really has that transformational possibility. How do we go about getting it more of it? And the other, though, is goes back to something that, you know, you've been talking about, that it's really by and for Jews of color. And I guess I was struck by something that I read about it where it described things that we've seen before as percentages, but it said there are 600,000 to a million Jews of color in America. That hit me. I was like, so then you don't have to talk about that as like, oh, and wouldn't it be great if it was more integrated into the rest of the Jewish community? I mean, you say like there's 600,000 or a million people. Let's just have them have a great life. You know, like in other words,
By 600,000 being a really important number to Jewish tradition, because 600,000 is the rough number of folks, or at least adult men. That's a true sexist issue, who leave Egypt. So like, we have a text that thinks 600,000 is a big old number.
Yeah, and like, you don't have to make arguments, how's this going to serve the rest of the Jewish community? Who cares? Like, this is for just serving those 600,000 or a million people. So I guess I'm wondering, though, from that perspective, what Jews of color organizations are popping up these days? And we've had Amud on the show, which is sort of like Svara in the sense that it's about learning with, you know, by and for Jews of color, like Svara is learning by and for LGBTQ Jews. But I'm thinking, like, I don't know of a queer and trans art organization. So what I'm asking is, when we think about groups of Jews who have not been well served by the mainstream institutions of Jewish life, what are the elements that you think should be there just to make it possible for that group of Jews to have the rich Jewish life that they deserve, because every Jew deserves to have a rich Jewish life? And like, what's missing? And in a way, I'm asking, what's missing for Jews of color? Like, what, why do you think that art in particular, if you do, is especially important for whether it's Jews of color or all those marginalized groups? And, or, you know, what else do you think there needs to be in order to build sort of a rich possibilities for those Jews who have not really found the rest of the Jewish community to be their place?
I do think that, you know, going back to Hamilton, I think that Lin-Manuel Miranda was very intentional in exactly what he was creating. And the real question was it going to be the cultural juggernaut that it became? There's no way to control that. It was a lot of preparation and also a heck of a lot of luck. And so when it comes to something breaking out for JOCISM arts, I think it's going to be the same thing. I think that there's just going to be something that just really takes off and people are going to be like, oh, wow, I am really drawn to this. And it's going to have these cultural ripples. I mean, maybe to some extent, the number of times people, you know, mentioned David Diggs, you know, being Black and Jewish and, you know, in the original cast of Hamilton and now doing wonderful screen stuff. And maybe that suddenly, you know, one of those things gets lucky. It gets ordered to series. It's on HBO for 6 seasons. And then bam, we've got this broader representation that is not simply focusing on like, oh, I am a Jew of color. Oh, these are my traumas and da, da, da. But that really is like focusing on a story, focusing on an experience, and not too worried about all of the hoopla that you sometimes have to address whenever you're working, you know, in a much more nonprofit setting where you're, you know, always seeking funders.
You know, funders are always looking for this magic bullet. They're always looking for something that has been all worked out in advance, and you can convince them that this one thing is going to be the thing that takes off. And I think really the more likely scenario is you just have a ton of stuff going on and one of them breaks through. And the 100%. Only way you can get the breakthrough is by losing all your money on the rest of the things that didn't go anywhere. That's exactly. Not a way that funders like to think.
Funders do not like to think that way, especially about the arts. I mean, I think that funders who happen to also invest in Broadway get that. But I think about like the Jewish funding ecosystem, it's far more conservative about how it does its funding. And yet I have to admit, a lot of the work that I do kind of amounts to selling people on a vision. And even if they're not going to see, you know, a penny of return on that, there's going to be a deeper kind of return in that you're going to have all these amazing artists who are suddenly going to feel this deeper connection to their Jewishness, but also feel that they don't need to address it in some parochial way that is very false for them. Like, I keep telling so many people, like, three of our fellows are currently involved with recent New York Times critics picks. It's like 3 out of 7. Like, that is huge. Now, however, I'm just thinking about the question you asked about what elements should there be. So this is something that might be a little, I don't know if it's going to be a hot take or anything like that, but I often think that the identity of Jews of color, Sephardi, Mizrahi, Indigenous, like, I don't think that it in and of itself as an identity, I don't think that it's enough. A lot of Jews of color I know have a lot of complex feelings around even the term Jews of color, and some notion of, oh, just because we're all Jews of color means that we're all heading to the same place. No, we're not. You know, what we're investing our time in, we're not all investing our time in the same thing, nor do we invest the same amount of stake in our identities in the same way. So we need to get rid of that notion as far as I'm concerned, which is part of the reason why with the workshop, I was focused on what is this JOCISM identity? Like, what is the other stuff that we're adding to it that makes that actually feel like it has more heft? And that's why I said, okay, professional artists who identify as JOCISM. Like, if I had told someone beforehand and not done the hard work of pulling this together, they would have been like, are you sure you can even find 7 of those kinds of people? And yet it was because I got so specific and have great friends who made great introductions that yes, we found exactly, you know, this wonderful group for our first cohort, and people feel so connected around this identity that more generally might have been a bit more challenging or problematic. So I think that in terms of what's missing, sometimes in JOC spaces, we need to get just much more specific about how is it that we want to be together? What is it we want to be working towards? For me, the goal is like art, art, art. And I think a lot can be accomplished through art. So that's my focus. But when I think more broadly around like what is needed, say for there to be, you know, an LGBTQ+ arts organization, Jewish arts organization, we honestly just need, there needs to be more money with fewer strings attached. When you trust, I'll keep it narrow to artists, when you trust artists to make what they want to make, you're going to get something that will be interesting, that might be provocative, but that's truly worthwhile.
I wanted to revisit a moment that I think is really important, which is the moment where you notice like, I'm a convert and all of the fellows that I work with aren't converts. With people who are both Jews of color and converts, I think sometimes we sort of collapse those issues into just Jews of color. And for all the reasons you just talked about, because we have this like massive term called Jews of color that we just treat with this big umbrella, we lose some of that nuance. So I would love to talk to you about, to the extent you're comfortable, your experience doing this as somebody who is a Jew by choice. And by the way, I'm aware that for some people, Jew by choice is very much the preferred term. For others, convert is very much the preferred term. Whatever terminology you prefer, I try to use both when I bring it up. But when I look around I mean, I'm just thinking of the stuff that like I watch on TV that's, you know, quote unquote Jewish television or Jewish movies, whatever. I don't see all that much representation of converts. I actually right. see more and more representation of Jews of color. Not sufficient yet, but I do think that that's happening. But I think of one of my favorite scenes that I've, you know, featured in presentations I do on Jewish pop culture, which is a scene from Orange is the New Black, where Cindy, who is black and in prison, she, in the most heartfelt, beautiful monologue, expresses how sincerely she wishes to convert to Judaism. And it's beautiful, and you could watch it as a feel-good story. But the end of the scene, I'm sorry for the spoilers, is actually that she is not permitted to be fully Jewish. The close of it is, you're Jew-ish. So I would love to hear from you. Like, am I right to say that there aren't that many converts being represented? Is that true? Obviously, nobody's done like a comprehensive survey, but I'm curious if that's like your anecdotal sense too. And if you have any sense of why that might be, like, part of me is nervous that because of all the crap we put in the way of converts, that we send this message that like, okay, you're allowed to participate in our Jewish things as they are, but you shaping them through Jewish art, that's less okay. And I'm curious if you would co-sign that or complicate that.
I think I'd probably co-sign and complicate. It's so funny that you bring up the episode with Black Cindy and Orange is the New Black season 3. And the only reason I know that is because I actually wrote and performed a monologue about someone approaching me at a party several years ago, back when I used to always wear like a kippah and a cap over that kippah. This person removes my hat off my head, sees my kippah, and says, oh my goodness, have you seen that episode of Orange is the New Black? So it's just like that sense wow. of, but even just the fact that you mentioned that and this happened to me shows the ways in which like popular culture gets like that becomes part of collective memory. And getting back to the question around Jews by choice, converts, and like the ways in which they are portrayed or not portrayed, you know, I think it's really complicated, because I think that it's a matter of it's really hard to understand for people. Like, hold up, what's the story of, okay, you became Jewish. Okay, that's inspiring in a general way, but especially when you're thinking about it in terms of like a TV show, for example, it's like, oh, how are you going to dramatize that? A lot of people don't know how to tell the story. And a lot of the writers definitely don't know how to tell the story. You know, sometimes they get lucky and land on a beautiful episode, like that episode of Orange is the New Black. But in many other cases, it's like, there's a kind of invisibility, and there's an existing in the margins. The thing that I am grateful for, though, is that it, at least in the conversations that I'm having, there's always a hunger for like stories that haven't been told, especially now. So I think that there is greater openness. The thing that I will be curious to see is how many converts will actually get a chance to be part of that process of telling these stories. Much in the same way that I'm curious how many Jews of color will also be able to be part of that process in shaping how these stories are told. In terms of converts being permitted to be participants, but not the movers and shapers of like Jewish life, Jewish tradition, that makes sense, especially inside of maybe more Jewish communal life spaces, where there's almost such a deep sense of like Jewish peoplehood and collective memory that this notion of maybe ceding that power to someone who learned it and went through this process, this very intentional process, can feel really destabilizing. It can be really frightening. And also there are the questions of like, oh, well, what does that say about my Jewishness, that this person who went through all of this process and maybe even at certain points knows more than I do is now vying to like take this leadership role. That question feels really relevant inside of Jewish communal spaces. I'm not sure about arts spaces, like maybe there's a bit more space there. And I mean, I don't think I'm speaking out of turn. And like, I've been fairly honest with people in my life. Had I not been ordained by JTS, would people give me the time of day inside of Jewish communal spaces? I would like to think that I'm a thoughtful enough person that they would. It would just be a matter of having a conversation, but I've got to be real. There's a way in which being part of, you know, this legacy institution, having graduated from it, it confers a certain amount of access to me and, you know, deems me kosher. I have experienced a lot of people being very comfortable with me leading, but had I not gone to a JTS or an HUC, I do ask the question of would that still be the case?
I'm thinking that maybe there's an underreported story. And incidentally, we recently got an email from a listener who suggested that we do a series on conversion, and we will. But in the meantime, I think there's this underreported story where maybe it was true, I have no idea, maybe it was never true, that a few decades ago, there was a very small number of people converting to Judaism, and those who were converting were very interested for one reason or another in becoming integrated into the various mainstream forms of Judaism that they were interested in, or maybe they were converting because of marriage, and there was not a sense that there was like a unique population of people who had converted to Judaism who may be sort of different from the, you know, want different things than the people that were born Jewish. And I'm definitely getting this impression. I'm no demographer, and this is all experiential and qualitative, but from our listeners, hey, all our listeners that are converting to Judaism or converted to Judaism, we hear a lot. We hear from a lot of
you. Hello to a lot of you.
A lot. And I have no idea if this represents this like enormous number of people that are out there, and it's just that they're kind of connecting, that somehow they're finding us, or these numbers are even bigger and they're all over the place. I think it's a story that should be told. The thing, though, that I'm experiencing from those who are listening to our podcast and who are now coming to Unyeshiva classes and all these things is that it's starting to feel to me like a distinct population, like queer and trans Jews or Jews of color. And maybe it's less formed yet, but actually feels that like their sense of what Judaism is and could be maybe a bit different or profoundly different from what the Judaism has been. And that's exactly what this podcast has always been all about. So we love those folks and we want to, you know, do whatever we can. Right. But I wonder if in a next phase, we might see a whole network of institutions like a place of study and a place of art and all the things that we know from the queer and trans community, or that now more and more in the Jews of color community, that would serve this community. I would find that kind of fascinating, and it would mess with a lot of people's notions of what it means to convert to Judaism, but I think in a good way. Anyway, so there's all that, but this is where it goes broader than converts, and it really focuses more, I think, a little bit on the kind of work that you've been doing through Reboot, which is, you know, again, maybe you can help me articulate this better, but maybe it goes to that, what Amichai is trying to say about rabbis or the new artists. It's when the medium of art is Judaism itself, not a play or a painting or a piece of music. It's saying that I can approach the stuff, the raw material of Judaism, and if I am an artist, and by that I mean an artist in my character, in my personality, not necessarily that I professionally go out and make paintings, but if I'm a kind of person who thinks like an artist, then I come to this pile and can rewire it and make something different out of it that is still made of the same stuff, but it's really different. That's one way that I see like what artists do. They come to a pile of paint and they make something out of it that is very different, but it still is made of the paint. And it feels to me like at least some of what Reboot does is to recruit people who have the artist's personality, because they actually are artists in more traditional media, and invites them to take the stuff of Judaism and make something a little bit different out of it, or maybe a lot different. And I'm wondering if that's a fair way to describe Reboot, and to the extent that some really interesting things have come out of Reboot, how could we have more of that going on in the Jewish world? Because I feel sometimes the category that I care most about, which is coming to the raw material of Judaism like an artist does, that's even less funded than the actual artist stuff.
Yeah, I really liked your description and kind of how it ties into Reboot, because that is how I often feel. You bring the stuff of Jewish tradition. It's almost like, what is it, that term from Gemara? Like when you take the term is Ramile, which is literally like throw them together. And it's where you take two sources of equal authority and you throw them together in order to try to get somewhere beyond the contradictions. And that's kind of how I feel about the reboot process. You get this Masorah, this tradition, this long Jewish tradition with all of these texts, all of this ritual technology, and you bring it to these creatives who you ask, like, what is this Jewish thing that you've inherited and what, if anything, do you want to do with it? And then you end up getting something like Saturday Night Seder. There's so much stuff to play with. We're going to give you a little bit of space to do that playing. And in terms of like my work with Reboot, so I was a rabbinic fellow and now I'm switching into a more kind of like rabbinic consultant, but I bring the full skills of, you know, these 5 years of rabbinical school and study into my conversations with creatives and artists who are part of the network. It's like, okay, what's the work we're trying to create? What's the impact we want it to have? And it often yields really interesting stuff. I think based upon like your question of how could we have more of that, we need to give people more permission to play with the raw materials. I really believe that. I'm also, you know, don't get me wrong, I believe in the value of like traditional prayer and the traditional structure and like the full, you know, prayer service. I very much believe in that. But people want to be invested, and especially if they're converts, or even if they're not converts, but they just don't, they feel ambivalent about their Jewishness. Like the number of times people approach me as a rabbi and it's like, oh, I'm deferential to like, I'm deferential to the rabbi. You know what you're doing. You know what you're doing with this ritual stuff. And more often than not, I'm saying, I'm really just trying to figure it out like you. Sure, I've done some study, but I'm really trying to recombine and reboot this for myself. How about we do this together? And I found that over the time of working with people, when you really give people that permission, they create interesting things. Sometimes it's, you know, it doesn't quite work, but that's okay. That's part of the process. That's what it means to be in community and actually to do Torah. You are in process. Because one of the critiques that often happens is like, oh, well, if you just let people recombine and redo whatever they want, you're just going to get this very weak kind of Judaism. That concern tends to be a relatively elitist concern. But taking that concern seriously, what I have often found just anecdotally is that, okay, it might start off relatively surface level, but the fact that people even want to engage in that process shows a deeper yearning. And whereas the first project might be a little surface level, the next project goes deeper. The number of times that I have worked with artists and then I describe Havdalah,
the Saturday night ritual that separates Shabbat from the rest of the week with a particular set of prayers and some really nice smells.
The ritual technology of it and also the meaning behind it. The number of times I hear, gosh, why don't I do this every week? There is that hunger, there's that yearning, and little by little, with the right kind of stewardship, I think we can get people to engage in it in deeper ways, but also on their own terms.
We, with great regret, have to close this conversation soon, but I will slip in another question, which I think is a little bit of a full circle situation, because early on, you talked about how art can be threatening. And I think that word threatening is important, and I want to unpack it because I actually agree. You'd think that in a show where we're talking about the value of art, we might want to downplay the ways in which art is threatening. I think art can threaten things that are bad. Like, I think art can threaten oppression. And we know this, right? Like, this is why books get banned. That's not news to anyone. And I wanted to close by asking you, like, about that threat and, like, why we might want to embrace the ways in which art can threaten. But also with the knowledge that, like, there is, like, I don't want to sound like we don't acknowledge concerns people have about what art can do to drastically change Judaism. I mean, I think about little moments, you know, we've talked about the Adam Sandler Hanukkah song, which I'm not going to claim is necessarily like the highest form of art. I do think it's an important form of art because it reached a lot of people. But like with one fell swoop, Adam Sandler sang a song on a Saturday night one week, and he told a bunch of people that Rod Carew, a baseball player, converted to Judaism. Rod Carew didn't convert to Judaism. That's actually not true. Talk about a person of color who was an involved and supportive spouse of a Jew, but he never actually did convert. Hall of Famer Rod Carew, he converted. That's like a thing that has probably been said hundreds and hundreds of times. So like, I'm aware that poor representation, that art in all sorts of ways can, in fact, threaten things that are good, too. But I wanted to close because as we're recording this, I'm going to cheat and I'm actually going to name when we're recording this. We don't usually do this. I woke up this morning and learned that David Burney, an actor, died. David Burney was the star of a show called Bridget Loves Bernie, which we've talked about on the show in the past, which was pulled from the air largely because Jewish institutions banded together across denominations, which is not a thing that Jewish institutions do, to say that a positive portrayal of intermarriage on television, on CBS, was not acceptable and it must be pulled from the air. And so it's not just abstract, right? It's not like, I think we could hear, Jewish art or art is threatening. And we could think, well, but really, are there Jews out there like canceling portrayals of art? Like, that's not happening, is it? But like, I think it does sometimes. Mm-hmm. And so I'm sort of curious to really like give you some hot button. Like, if there are specific things that you have been told you can't do or that threaten in specific ways, like, you know, we've talked with Bruchim, the organization supporting folks who are choosing not to circumcise. Like, there could be art out there that like wants to problematize circumcision. There could be art out there that wants to say God doesn't exist through a Jewish life. I mean, I don't know. There's like really intense things that art could do. And I guess what I'm asking you is, should we see that as exciting?
It is a good thing that these issues, which could be seen as threatening, which could be seen as problematic, which could be seen as challenging, I think it's a good thing that they are being brought up. And I think that in the hands of skilled artists, they're handled in profound ways that it takes years to unpack. I vote for that. And the reason that I vote for that is because I believe what's on the other side will be better. I don't want to downplay either this notion that like, there are some who would make the claim, oh, art is, it's always about showing us the ways in which we are all the same and bringing us together. And no, that's only certain types of art. There are other types of art which can be much more combative because it's trying to draw attention to an issue. It's trying to change hearts and minds on a really essential, important issue. Artists have a responsibility to not only their own practice, but also to be rigorous. Now, it's possible, like, you know, to write a song, a very quick song, you know, that might get play on Saturday Night Live or something like that to, you know, draw attention to like, oh, this person's a convert or this person. But the reason that I'm saying that it's important to be rigorous is because you never know exactly how an audience is going to take something. You can only do your best to try to think through like what the perspectives of the audience will be. I think with art that feels threatening, that feels problematic, I'm actually excited for that art because it's actually saying something that about conversations that really need to be had. And because we don't have enough distance from it as human beings, we don't have the conversations. Instead, we go into silos on social media or we limit our friend groups. So art can point up those points of contention. And when in the hands of really skillful artists, it might even be able to take us beyond our own points of view. I know that I have found myself challenged in that way, thinking like, oh, I'm going to watch this show and I'm going to come away feeling completely affirmed in my perspective, only to find myself troubled. And that's exciting. I am all for challenging art. And it's possible for it to be challenging and incredibly entertaining as well. For example, the recent show that opened up on Broadway, A Strange Loop by the musical theater writer Michael R. Jackson, is point and proof of that. I mean, it's a story about a queer, fat, Black, gay man writing a story about a queer, fat, Black, gay man writing a story about a queer, fat, Black, gay man. So it's very, very meta, but it's asking these really challenging and hard questions about like, what is sexuality? What is love? What does it mean to love oneself? What about self-hate? And it is incredibly entertaining, and I live for work that can find that balance. So we shouldn't be afraid of it. What's on the other side will be better.
Thank you so much, Kendall Pinckney, for joining us. This has been a fantastic conversation.
Happy to join you all. Can't wait till the next time.
Same here. We are so looking forward to the next time we get to schmooze with Kendall Pinckney. And we want to say to all of you out there who listen to this conversation, thank you. And before we go... What? Sorry. I'm sorry, is that Shavuot knocking at the door? Is that, I think Shavuot is making its presence felt. I think Shavuot is knocking and saying, oh my gosh, this holiday, this once a year festival that comes after 7 weeks of countdown, it's here. It starts on Saturday, June 4th. This episode is being released on Friday, June 3rd. That means that Shavuot is right around the corner, and Shavuot Live, the biggest, bravest, greatest event of the Judaism Unbound calendar, is in fact back. We are thrilled that almost 500 people have already registered. Many, many, many more are going to be registering in the next couple days for our 24 hours of Jewish learning. You definitely want to be there. No matter where in the world you are, you can join us. We'll have people from all sorts of continents learning, teaching, Zooming, schmoozing, all that good stuff. You can register by heading to JudaismUnbound.com and then just clicking the Shavuot Live button. Or if you're really fancy, you can type in bit.ly/Shavuot2022. That will take you to our registration page. So we hope to see you there. It's a highlight of our year every year. And yeah, definitely join us. So the last thing that we'll say is that we really appreciate it when you are all in touch with us. And there are a wide variety of ways that you can do so. First, there's our Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram pages. All of those are at Judaism Unbound. Second, there's our website, JudaismUnbound.com. Third, there's our email addresses. You can email us at dan@JudaismUnbound.com or lex@JudaismUnbound.com. The last request we'd like to make is that we deeply appreciate any amount of financial donation that you can send our way, which you can do on a monthly recurring basis or just as a one-time gift via JudaismUnbound.com/donate. So thank you so much for listening. And with that, this has been Judaism Unbound. 100%.